You ready?
What do we do on three?
Nothing. It's just a matter of, it's just to allow me to sync up the two things.
Now, are we going to go on three or one, two, and then
three? Then one, two, three, go. Okay. All right. Ready? Just do it simultaneously. One.
One.
Two.
Two.
Three.
Three.
Go.
Go!
Back to the bin.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another somewhat war-related episode. Welcome to Back to the Bins. I'm David A. Pascarella, and I'm joined with the producer of this fantastic program, Mr. Paul Spataro.
I think it's Private First Class Paul Spataro.
I thought you were an officer. Oh, no, you work for a living, right?
You know, we do seem to be really doing a lot of these war episodes, but these two books I thought were fun. Some of the books, it's like, well, you know, it just feels like it's so cliche and whatever, but these two were fun. So I'm going to tell you in advance, I'm going to have high ratings on these two books.
I'm going to tell you too. Me too.
So this is probably of the war books that we've done together. This is probably the best combo that we've had. There may have been a book that was better than one of these or both of these, but as far as the two books we're doing, this is the best ones that we've had in combination, in my humble opinion.
And I had read your book as well prior to this, so I was familiar with that story.
Prior to the, oh, that's right. Yes. You did that Marvel read through that you were doing.
Yes.
So, just for the sake of telling people, we are handling, we're doing war books, but we are not doing Storming Paradise this time around.
Now we need a break from that.
So, and then we still probably next time we record, maybe we'll do another Commandy episode because we're a little behind on that. So, but I brought Sergeant Fury number 27, which is a somewhat pivotal issue because, and I did this, all this research, just like crazy doing research, hours and hours and hours. Sergeant Fury was introduced in Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos number 1, which we have covered in connection with Storming Paradise number 2, in fact. And that had a cover date of May of 1963. He was introduced as a modern-day character in Fantastic Four number 21, which was December of 1963. He also appeared in Sergeant Fury Annual number 1 in modern day with a cover date of October of 65. Those were his two first modern-day appearances, and in those he did not have an eye patch. The next time he appeared, he had an eye patch, and it was like, well, why does he have an eye patch? You know why he has an eye patch? Probably because they thought it was pretty mysterious looking. From didn't one of the guys have an eye patch in From Russia with Love?
Oh, I thought Thunderball. Wasn't it Thunderball?
Maybe it was Thunderball. I'm not sure, but yes. You know, it's. I think it created that secret agent spy mystique to have him have a an eye patch.
Eye patches were very big in the '60s. I think.
Well, the eye patch, the cigarette holder, yeah. You know.
If you had both, you knew you were the bad guy.
Well, but he's a good guy and he has the eye patch.
But he didn't have a cigarette holder.
But no cigarette holder. Red Skull always had a cigarette holder. So then they did this issue, which came out in, it was released on December 9th of 65 and cover dated February of 66, which is Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos number 27. And the cover promises us that, hold on, just want to open it up here. It says, at last, the origin of Fury's eye patch.
Ooh. That, Now, didn't you look at that and go, well, what kind of crap is this? Because he had an eye patch. He didn't have an eye patch when he first showed up in the 60s.
But that's, they had to explain that away, and they do, which I think is, you know, they retconned it right to be, you know, so that there's an explanation for it. It's a kind of a dumb explanation, but it's an explanation just the same.
Did you do research on medical conditions?
I did not. I did not look up any ailments of the eye. I did not pull out the tomes of ophthalmological sources to see if there is such a situation. This book had the massive cover price of 12 cents. Oh. The cover was by Dick Ayers, and it shows Fury with a bandage over his left eye in what appears to be a German saloon among a crew of Nazi officers, reaching for a gun inside his jacket. The cover indicates trapped inside Hitler's Reichland. Fury fights alone. And then, as I mentioned, there's a large inset of Fury with the eye with his eye bandaged, and it says, at last, the origin of Fury's eye patch. The story is titled Fury Fights Alone. The script is by Stan Lee, art by Dick Ayers, delineation by John Tartaglione, I assume that means the inking, and lettered by Sam Rosen. The premise of the story, given on the splash page, is that the Nazis have developed a strange new weapon for shooting down Allied bombers. Instead of a gun, it's a deadly, infallible beam of light. The Howler's mission, destroy the fatal beam at all costs. The story opens with the Howling Commandos being airdropped into Germany to seek out and destroy the Nazis' new beam weapon. Dum Dum Dugan is armed with a new type of bazooka, but as they drop, they are spotted by a group of Nazis who look to capture them at the drop site. But by the time they arrive, the Howlers are ready for them and seek cover in a viaduct. However, as they watch, an Allied bomber is bathed in the light rays from the beacon that causes the plane's engines to fail. The men aboard are forced to parachute to safety. Meanwhile, a Nazi soldier is being interrogated by Fury. Although he says he won't betray the fatherland, they convince him to call in an advised command that Allied planes are incoming and that they'll need to raise the beacon. When they do that, Dum Dum Dugan blasts it with the bazooka. At that moment, the Nazi tosses a grenade at them, which Fury catches and throws in another direction. Way to go, Nick. He's caught partially in the blast, sustaining damage to his eye, which Dino wraps in a bandage / eye patch. As soon as that's done, Fury takes the bazooka and orders the Howlers to clear out. He shoots the bazooka and tosses a good old American grenade and quickly makes his way down a country road where he encounters a German civilian and steals that man's clothing. He encounters a patrol and points as if to say, they went that away. And the patrol goes off in that direction, encountering the German citizen, who tells them what happened. But they are skeptical, causing him to run, and they shoot him in the leg and bring him in. Nazi justice. Fury makes his way to the city of Brandenburg and finds himself in a beer garden where he observes a group of Nazis discussing the destruction of the beacon. One of them is Dr. Drauss, the inventor of the beacon. It seems that he won't give anyone the plans for the beacon, keeping them only in his head to maintain his own value. The group is headed by Marshal Goering, who recognizes Fury. Fury delays them by pretending to be a spy disguised as Fury, but when they don't buy it, he starts to kick some Nazi butt. Dr. Drauss turns to a soldier for help, but unfortunately he has been treated poorly by Drauss, and Fury is able to convince him that he'd be better off switching sides. And so Fury and his new ally take Drauss as a prisoner and make their way to an airfield, commandeering a plane. On the other side of the channel, Dum Dum is requesting permission to go search for Fury and is told that rival sergeant, Sergeant McGivney, and his maulers have been charged with the rescue mission. As they debate the merits of this plan, Fury and his two companions burst in. Fury is sent straight to the infirmary where he's treated by the doctor, who indicates he'll be able to keep his eye, but that he requires a crucial operation. When Fury refuses because he's needed in the war effort, he's told that he will eventually lose the eye, although the doctor can't say how long it will take for that to happen. The end. So wow. It is kind of a very, very convenient, well, he's going to lose it eventually. We don't know when. Oh, it's going to be between Sergeant Fury Annual Number 1, and I don't even know when the next appearance is after that. I did not, my research omitted to check that.
But they say he's going to go blind in the eye, right?
Yeah.
So what do you need an eye patch for? Typically, yeah, you wore an eye patch if you lost the eye.
Yeah, if the eye, well, you know, maybe he, maybe the eye like deteriorated to the point where it had to be removed.
Okay, well, no prize that way. So, are you familiar? I don't recall. This stuck out of my memory because it's such, you know, a pivotal thing with the eye patch. Was Sergeant McGivney in these? You know, like, was he a recurring character?
I suspect that he was, but I don't know that for certain. I have open, let me see. I have opened the Marvel Wiki page, and I'm clicking on him now. It doesn't say first appearance, so I'm thinking he's not, and I'm clicking on him, waiting for the screen to update. I should play our music at that point.
Does he not look our elevator like Dan Turpin from the Superman comics?
Yeah, he does.
I mean, come on.
You do have to see the picture of him on the Marvel Wiki page, though. Let's see. Sergeant Bull McGivney was the leader of the second attack squad of Captain Happy Sam Sawyer's Able Company. Both he and his squad were in constant rivalry with Nick Fury and his Howling Commandos, causing endless brawls, which often ended in both squads being sent to the brig. Once because McGivney had picked a fight with a shy army private named Steve Rogers. Interesting. First appearance. Where is that? First appearance was Sergeant Fury number 7. So he is a known character by this point. I don't know how many times between 7 and 27 he appeared. There is an issue of Sergeant Fury with Captain America on the cover. I couldn't tell you which one. I do not have it. But I assume that's going to be the issue where McGivney picks on Steve Rogers. Let me see, because there's a footnote on that. If I can go down, where is the?
I mean, you have Sergeant to Fury
number. Sergeant Fury number 13, which is the one with Captain America and Bucky on the cover.
You'd have to think that would be a no-brainer to talk, you know, cross over Captain America in this series.
Oh yeah, I don't think they did it all that often though. I do think they, like when they revived Captain America and then when he got his own series in Tales of Suspense, I think that there was a reasonably, or at least my memory is that there was a reasonably frequent Nick Fury appearance, or at least more so than you would see in other series, just because there was enough of a connection there.
Because I think there's a period with Cap where it's stories taking place during the war, right? And then all of a sudden they shift it and they bring him into the present.
Yeah, that's when they introduced the series in Tales of Suspense, they went with a lot of flashback to the war issues or stories. And then I think those proved to be less popular than they were hoping. And then they brought it to modern day. But, yeah, you know, it was easier to have flashback stories and Tales of Suspense and then have his current adventures in the Avengers than to have both going on. But eventually, you know, they managed. That's really why they had at one point removed Thor and Iron Man from the Avengers, because it was easier to have Scarlet Witch and Quicksilver and Hawkeye, who none of which had their own series. So, you know, whoever was writing, whether it was Stan or Roy, they didn't have to worry about conflicting with what was going on in their main series.
Right. But I kind of always felt with that, when you took out the big guns, it became to me a little bit like the Detroit League, you know, when Justice League, they took all the big guns out.
It did. There was definitely a feeling like that, but I got to say, I did enjoy, you know, I mean, what they call Cap's kooky quartet. And we covered, Bill and I on Avengers Spotlight have covered a lot of those issues. I think we were just getting to the point where they you added in, you know, the Wasp and, which, you know, Giant Man became Goliath and he came back. And that's, you know, at some point not too far off from there, he had lost his series in Tales to Astonish and was replaced by the Submariner in that, which made it easier for them to tell his stories or, you know, their stories without conflicting. So what did you think of this story, though?
I thought it was a lot of fun. I mean, it's told in such a way that, yeah, it kind of works with the revealing the eye patch.
But and then you know, the little twist at the end where he's going to lose his eye eventually, but we don't know when.
So it fits the continuity.
Yeah.
Perfect. I mean, the whole... So the Germans came up with laser weapons before everybody else, huh?
Apparently. But, you know, that was the one aspect of the story that I was trying to just kind of make sense of in my mind. It was like, if this guy was being, you know, he was being, I guess, self-preserving by keeping the information in his own head, you know, saying, I can recreate these things anytime I want, but I'm not going to tell you how because I want to keep my own value.
Yeah. I don't see that going over well.
No, first of all, I don't see that going over well. And second of all, I would think either they would torture the information out of him.
Well, go home. We have your family here.
Yeah. Or they would just reverse engineer it. You know, make him make one, and then you just say, all right, yeah, take that to the lab and figure out how it works.
Start taking his toes off.
And then you have somebody yell out, you know, Dr. Drauss made this in a cave with scraps.
I'd like to know.
What do you think of the... Oh, go ahead.
They also invented a whole new bazooka just to take that out. Is that a one-shot wonder?
What is the bazooka? Was it Laws Rocket?
I think that's the modern version.
Yeah. And I'm thinking this one is supposed to be similar to that, even though it's, whatever, 30 years earlier.
We've only got one of them.
And the inventor of that is keeping it secret, too.
It's Howard Stark invented that. Well, how do you like the guy who Fury strips his clothes?
Oh, yeah,
why is he wearing red long underwear?
I think that was more common back then. You know, I think they called it a union suit.
Really?
The big onesie, the big red onesie. I remember on the show F Troop that they would have those, like when they were in the bunks sleeping, they'd get up and they'd have the red onesies on.
I guess. Or he could have just went Shazam.
I got a kick out of that whole scene, though. Then, you know, that the guy, when he's met up by the patrol, that he's like, you know, he's explaining to them what happened. They're like, I don't believe you. If what you said was true, he would have killed you. So the fact that you're still alive tells me that you're a bad guy. And they shoot him in the leg. I don't know why they didn't just, well, whatever. But that's another, like, thing that I always find somewhat troublesome is when people say, well, you know, the police should always aim for like somebody's leg or whatever. And it's like,
very hard.
You know, life doesn't work that way. That's fine in the movies when you have people who can, you know, shoot a fly out of the air with a gun. But, you know, in real life, you're taught to shoot for center mass because you're more likely to actually hit. You know, you start aiming for somebody's leg or something, odds are, first of all, that you're not going to hit it. And second of all, you're probably going to make him lose his leg anyway.
Yeah. It's pretty easy.
Or you're not going to disable him.
It's easier to hit a target when no one's shooting back at you.
It's also easier to hit a target that isn't moving. So, you know, that's something that, like, whenever... I always remember that in Lethal Weapon, Yeah, it's in the first one when Danny Glover's like, and you know, I try to shoot them in the leg. And it's like, yeah, right, Danny, okay. Because he keeps talking about how Mel Gibson's such a you know, a loose cannon, and that he, you know, he's killing the people that they have to, when he has to shoot somebody.
Have a nice day.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the fact, though, that Nick Fury was able to just gesture and they, oh, he went that away, and it was no problem. He didn't get asked any questions whatsoever.
Because he's dressed.
I mean, of all the things, would you think the American spy would be the guy running in his long red underwear down the side of the road?
I like the fact that when Fury took his stuff, he also apparently took some white gloves and a walking stick.
Well, he was stepping out.
Yeah. He's definitely looking like he's styling.
Now, if he was really swift, he would have bandaged up his throat and made it like he couldn't speak, because of that wound.
Yeah, he could be Taylor from Planet of the Apes. What do you think of the artwork?
I thought the artwork was good. I liked it.
I think Dick Ayers lends himself well to this type of story. I don't think his, like, his superhero work is necessarily on point, but his his work on, like, war books and westerns,
yeah,
I think is fitting. The biggest John Tartaglione fan as far as the inking goes, though. It's not bad. It's a little rough in a couple of spots where I feel like it could have been smoothed out.
Well, I'm looking at page 12. Take a look at page 12. The flunky center square. You look at that face, it just says Nazi.
So I'm just looking for page 12, actually. Yeah. 10, 11, 12. Oh, yeah.
Right? I mean, you look at that. Oh, he's a Nazi, no doubt.
Yeah,
And Eugene Levy is in the panel. Dr. Dawes looks like Eugene Levy in that shot.
But then, but the one you were saying, you know, looks like a Nazi, he's the one who ends up turning mm-hmm. traitor on them. And Fury's like, why the hell are you going to listen to these people? And then he goes with them. And then, you know, ultimately, like, it's almost like there's a mutual respect, though, because, you know, he says something like, you know, I knew you would be a man of your word to Fury.
And we get a guest appearance by Herman Gorey, who was mentioned in our last Storming Paradise.
Yes.
Couldn't get his
fat ass. It's all connected. It's all connected.
Couldn't get his fat ass off the ground.
Well, what does Fury do with him? Fury hits him with another guy, swings a guy around and whacks him with him.
How tough are you that you can just pick up another guy and knock someone out with the guy?
Like, you swing him like a baseball bat.
Right. Jeez, he should have went to play for the Dodgers back in 45. It's yeah, so much fun.
Maybe if he had, they wouldn't have lost so many World Series to your Yankees.
Who's a bum? Let me tell you the music. Can we take a side line here?
Sure.
My deceased father would tell the story repeatedly how he was a Yankee fan. Was he? No, he was a Giants fan, a New York Giants fan. And they only had
as
one
was TV. My dad.
And they only had one TV in the house. And his father was a Yankee fan, so he couldn't watch the games. So he made like a big announcement. He says, this year, I'm going to be a Yankee fan. And he would say, and what happens? Bobby Thompson hits the shot heard around the world. The Giants win the pennant. Thank you very much.
They were just waiting for him to leave.
They were waiting for him to leave. But he would always end the story with, thank you very much.
My dad was a Giant fan growing up. Then as I was growing up, he was following the Mets. And, you know, my dad was a New York City cop. And at one point, one of his partners was Rocco Torri, Joe Torre's brother. So in the late 70s, when Torri played for the Mets and then, you know, into the early 80s when he managed them, once a year we used to get tickets from Joe Torri, you know, right behind home plate underneath the netting. So, you know, I was, you know, that's really the origin of my being a huge Met fan. But then it's funny because towards the end, my dad started rooting for the Yankees. And he was like, you know, I'm 80 years old and I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. I can't wait for the Mets to win a World Series.
That would have been perfect if as soon as he changed teams, the Mets won the World Series.
But he was more of the I'm going to root for the New York teams kind of person.
Yeah, that's how my father was too.
My dad was like that. My sister is like that. And even to some extent, Tina's like that. And they're all like, why can't you root for the Yankees? I'm just like, I just can't. Sorry, I don't see you rooting for the Mets either.
Until my ex-wife came along. I used to be that way.
What do you mean? You used to root for both teams?
I want to see the New York team win. If the Yankees weren't in it, why would I not want to see the Mets win? Until, you know, she was a rabid Met fan. And after September 11th, she's rooting for Arizona? The city's trying to come back and you're rooting against us? That was the end of that.
I was tired of the Yankees winning the World Series by 2001, but it's funny because it's the one bad apple spoils the whole bunch theory. Yeah. Because most of the Yankee fans I know are fine, and most of the reasons I have for rooting against the Yankees are the fans who aren't, the fans who feel the need to just be kind of asinine about it. And I'm sure most people who root against the Mets, it's the same exact thing in reverse. That's not so much the players on the team or the team itself. It's the fans that you don't want to see celebrating the victories.
If you took them out of the equation, it's like, why would you not want to see the team from your city win?
Yeah, it's that way for me with football because I'm a Jets fan, which is just makes me a sad, sad person. But the people who I'm friends with who are Giant fans, none of them act objectionable about it. So I have no problem rooting for the Giants to win if the Jets are not winning. So, you know, the only time I root against the Giants is if they're playing the Jets.
And that would make sense.
But
we're going to get called into human resources by Scott when he listens to this. What the hell are you talking about on this program?
Well, just for what it's worth, though, I cannot root for the Yankees or the Rangers. I can't. And, you know, I know this is such a tangent. They were talking today, as we record this, yesterday they had a new pitcher pitch for the Yankees who grew up in the Boston area. So this morning on sports radio, they were talking about his parents who were there at the game wearing Yankee paraphernalia. And they were saying, you know, if your child played for a team of the arch enemy of your team, could you openly root for that team to win? So for me, it would be okay if one of my kids, you know, was a player on the Yankees, would I be rooting for them? And let's put it really in perspective. If they were playing the Mets in the World Series, would I be able to root for the Yankees because my kid is on the team? And I say, as rabid of a fan as I am, absolutely. If one of my kids is on the team, I would have no problem. I might not wear the paraphernalia. But, you know, I would still be a Mets fan and root for the Mets, but I would be rooting for my child over everything else.
And think of the seats you would probably have.
Yeah.
You have no soul if you wouldn't root for your kid playing.
Well, one of the guys on the sports radio show was saying, well, I don't know. I really have a tough time, but I don't think he has any kids. And it's really easy to say if you don't have any kids, but if you have a kid and you know, how could you possibly root for them to fail? And then they even brought into the equation, well, you know, and if they win, they're going to make more money and they're going to, you know, they're going to be better off in life. And it's like, yeah, it's not just a matter of the prestige of winning. It's beyond that. So anyway, back to Sergeant Fury and his Howling Commandos.
I don't think you could fit three people in that plane. I think it was a
That looks like a two-seater to me. That does.
Unless he was sitting on his lap. Who knows?
And he's lucky that the guy that he convinced to go AWOL for the Germans knew how to fly it.
It's a bunch of lucky coincidences.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and what happens here? I'm just trying to see when they escape from Germany.
Right.
Fury's shirt is apparently intact, but when they come into the meeting, he's just got tatters on.
Oh, that's because he beat up the MPs to get to him. Doesn't he say something like that? Yeah, because you see all the thud, bam, whop, wow. He fights his way through. Holy cow, only one man could have fought his way through half the MPs on the base.
They ripped the shirt off his back.
He's like Captain Kirk. He was Captain Kirk before Captain Kirk.
You know what? Couldn't you see William Shatner playing this if they made this into a TV show?
Yes, I could. Especially back young Shatner, yeah.
I think the next time we do a Sergeant Fury issue, I don't know when that's going to be, but we need to cast the Howling Commandos in a 1960s movie.
Oh my God, that would be so much fun.
and then the only thing is we've already said William Shatner, so now you have to come up with somebody else.
Oh, see, now okay? That's
so just tough. We'll plan that for next time.
Good. That sounds good.
So if I saw this on the stands, I have no doubt I would be picking this up. I think the cover is pretty cool. It's a little different from what you'd expect because of the giant inset of the close up of him with the bandage and saying the origin of his eye patch. But the shot of him among the German officers in the beer garden is very cool. It's well drawn. I like even, you know, the steins on the tables. Just really pretty top notch as far as I'm concerned. I'm going to say an A- on the cover. Not iconic, but pretty good. The artwork, I like the artwork. I think it fits the style of the story very well. Again, I'm not that crazy about the John Tartaglione inking. Think it could be a little cleaner in spots. I'm going to say I liked it a lot despite that. I'm going to say a B+ on the interior artwork. And the story is a hell of a lot of fun. And I'm going to say an A on the story. And overall, I'm going to give the book an A-.
I'm right there with you. I love the cover. I definitely would have picked this one up if I was walking by the rack. I get a kick out of how Goering's hat is flying right off his head. He's so shocked. I'm going to give the cover an A. I think the interior art's very good, too. It's definitely well above average. I think it comes in at a solid B+ on the art. And the story is an A. For an overall grade of an A- on this one.
Well, so we're right in step with each other on that one.
We're like in the same ballpark, so like, to speak.
Well, like Nazi soldiers in formation. So we're going to jump to the modern day war book now.
Yes, we're rolling up to 1982 with G.I. Joe, a real American hero.
He's always there, fighting for freedom over land and air. G.I. Joe, G.I. Joe's there. G.I. Joe is the code name for America's daring, highly trained special mission force. Its purpose, to defend human freedom against Cobra, a ruthless terrorist organization determined to rule the world. He never gives up, he'll stay till the fight's won. G.I. Joe will dare.
Cover dated August of 82, on sale May 4th of 82, for a whopping 60 cents. written by Larry Hama, penciler Don David Perlin, inker Jack Abel, and editor Tom DeFalco. And our issue is entitled Panic at the North Pole. An American research station in the North Pole has been raided. All personnel killed, and its records are missing. General Austin is briefed via video link by the colonel leading the team sent up to investigate the silent station. The general decides that the mission to look further into the attack is one for G.I. Joe, as there's been no word from Moscow, and they don't want to risk making a sticky situation stickier. General Flagg selects the members of the team, all of whom have their leave cut short. Stalker is retrieved from a wildlife photo trip in Wisconsin. Breaker from running computer programs on the computers at MIT. Scarlet from a San Diego martial arts tournament. And Snake Eyes from an isolation tank at Columbia University. Flagg briefs the team en route to the pole. Their primary mission is reconnaissance, and they are told not to initiate contact. If fired upon, they are to withdraw and seek further instructions. The secondary mission is the retrieval of the station's missing records. The team parachutes in and observes a nearby Russian installation. An Eskimo with a 30 caliber machine gun arrives via dog sled. He goes into the research station for a minute, then departs, leaving the door open. The Joes determine that no one leaves doors open in the Arctic unless no one's home. And if no one's home, they can't initiate contact by going in. The Joes enter the station and find the researchers dead, having frozen to death from a malfunctioning heater. The research records are missing. They also find an ultra-low frequency transmitter capable of affecting human brain waves. But the key part is missing. Snake Eyes spots an explosive planted under a table, and they barely escape with their lives. The team sends the photos taken to General Flagg, who responds with a dossier on the unknown Eskimo. He's a mercenary named Quinn, a freelance special ops enforcer who has worked for the CIA, Mossad, and KGB. He's always known for fulfilling his contracts to the letter, never lies, and never divulges any information about former employers. The Joes track Quinn to the plane he arrived in, but Quinn knows they are there and booby traps his campsite with C4 plastic explosives. Quinn forces them to surrender and takes their supplies and ammo. He reveals that he was hired to eliminate all evidence of the Russians' experiments with fear waves. He took the records from the American Research Station and the Russians' frequency modulator. He divulges he and the crew of the wrecked plane will be picked up by a Russian submarine at precisely noon tomorrow. Not any earlier, not any later, precisely at noon. He divulges this to them because they're dead. They have no supplies and no radio. Stalker refuses to give up and orders his team to strip whatever useful material they can from the wrecked plane. They cobble together an ice sailboat and outrace Quinn's dog sled. At an ice bridge, the Joes use some ammo Snake Eyes had hidden and Quinn's C4 to set up an explosive trap. Quinn, however, sends his dog sled through as a decoy and again gets the drop on the team. Snake Eyes manages to retrieve his weapon from Quinn, but learns Quinn has removed the firing pins from their guns and added them to his weasel skull necklace as a form of good luck. Quinn admits he hates what the Russians are doing with fear waves, but must uphold his contract. Quinn meets up with the Russian contacts 2 hours before the scheduled submarine pickup and gives them the records and the frequency modulator, confirming with them that he has fulfilled his contract. He then informs the Russians that he will be leaving, as he detests violence and wants to be as far away from there when the Joes arrive. The Russians accuse him of betraying them, but he informs them that he has fulfilled his contract to the letter. He further tells the Russians that he left his weasel skull necklace a mile from where they are as an offering to the spirits, hoping that fear would vanish from the world. The Joe team is about 4 miles from the location compared to the Russians' one. The Russians' only hope is to find the necklace before the Joes do. Unfortunately, the Joes are trackers and the Russians are not. The fully armed Joes travel across the snow with Snake Eyes wearing Quinn's necklace. And that is our story.
You know, we did the first issue of G.I. Joe a little while back. And we did the first issue of Captain Savage. And the talk we had with both was the value of introducing the characters and giving you some background and giving you a feel for who the characters are or were, so that when you're reading it, you start to connect with them a little bit. And I believe I complained with regard to G.I. Joe number one, that they didn't really give me that. They didn't give me enough of a connection to the characters as they introduced them. And I believe with regard to Captain Savage, my thought was they gave us way too much because they were constantly telling you what their motivation was in a very, very unrealistic manner. So this issue, I felt, hits the perfect balance. They introduce you to each character on the G.I. Joe team and Quinn. And they give you just enough background so that you could start to know who they are, to make them a little bit more three-dimensional and make them a little bit more relatable and make the story much more interesting. So this issue does for me what I wanted issue one to do.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I don't even think in the first issue we knew that Snake Eyes was deformed. We only find out now.
I think you're right.
He wears a mask, but...
Yeah, you didn't know why.
Right.
And also just, you know, that he's in the sensory deprivation tank so that, you know, there's more going on. Each one of these characters is given, you're given a little background and you're given some personality, but you're not given the whole story. There's still enough, you know, to wait and see what's going to happen. And, you know, Hama is giving himself some room to play with.
Yeah.
So I really feel like this, as far as the writing in this story, I feel like this is almost a perfect issue for an introduction to a new team like this. Again, I don't know why they saved it for issue two. If this was issue one, if issue one didn't exist and this was just issue one, exactly as it is, I'd be good with it.
I think I've developed a theory behind that. I think
I'd like to hear it.
If you'll give me a moment. I think that since this was tied into the toy line, the first book, they wanted them, you need to showcase everything. As in, we want to move product. You need to show all the characters. You have to show all the equipment that we're selling. Because they managed. At the time this came out, there were, I think, 9 Joes. There were 3 vehicles and the tank. And that's what's shown in the book. It was a marketing thing. Once you got past that initial introduction, okay, now you can tell whatever story it is you want to tell. I have a feeling that maybe Hasbro was the driving force behind that.
You very well could be right. That would make a lot of sense. But from a marketing point of view, while that may have sparked some interest in the toy line, I don't think it sparked as much interest in the comic. I think that they kind of dropped the ball a little bit as far as the comic goes in the first one. But again, this one really does it for me. This is just enjoyable. It's easy to get into. Like I said, each character has their own individual personality. They're not just, you know, interchangeable. A lot of stuff that I like in this. The artwork is interesting. It's Don Perlin, who I've always liked. Don Perlin, I always thought his artwork was not spectacular. He's not one of these artists where you're going to say, oh, it's great stuff. I wish I had original copies of it. But it's very, very easy to work with. Don Perlin, I'm mostly familiar with from his work on The Defenders in the later issues. And it's very clean. And what I'm noticing, or what I noticed as I read this for today, was it is very similar in style to what Herb Trimpe eventually did on G.I. Joe. Yeah. I don't know if Trimpe was trying to kind of conform to this, or if they just have, fairly similar styles to begin with. I mean, some of their facial images are different. Some of their facial styling is different. But as far as the just general feel of the book, it's very similar.
Yeah, the styles will be perfected as they go along. Mm-hmm. And there'll be changes. But this is, it's good. I like it.
The only thing I got to say, when we're introduced to Scarlet, or when we are first introduced to Scarlet, I guess it is, this woman with she's got like a tribble on her head. What the heck is that?
That's the early 80s.
Yeah, that's terrible.
Isn't it funny to think about, how certain aspects have so changed over the years, particularly Breaker with the computer, that he's got to go to MIT to futz around with a computer.
Mm. Well, just when you think about how computers have advanced in our lifetimes, it's phenomenal. When they say, and I don't think it's an exaggeration, that the phones we carry have more working ability computer wise than what originally was taken into outer space, to go to the moon.
Yeah.
It's a phenomenal thought when you think about it. And it's kind of scary to think about what they went to the moon with when you put it in that kind of perspective.
Well, it seemed back then it was more of the, we can just do this. You know what I mean? Guts and determination.
Yeah, I agree. So it's just very cool. I like Quinn. Now he's a recurring character, right?
He will return, but it will be, I think, 10 issues later.
He has, the mercenary with a sense of honor, which is there's a little bit of a, stereotype as far as storytelling goes with that. You see that in a lot of books. I'm thinking of the one I'm thinking of is Batroc the Leaper, who's a mercenary with a sense of honor. But it's still a cool concept to have in here. I also like the character model because he's stocky and he looks like he could really just kick some ass.
And what's funny? He was popular when in the issues that will come later, he becomes a quite popular character, and they never made a figure of him.
Oh, that's interesting.
I mean, they may have been modern times, but
back then, I'm assuming they find themselves up against him sometimes and on the same side as him sometimes, depending on what the missions are.
He will return. See? We'll just say he returns for a while.
Okay. According to the printout, he's 6'10" tall and 280 pounds. So he's a big dude. Expert tracker, hunter, woodsman, speaks English, Russian, French, Finnish, German, and 3 Inuit dialects. Expert with rifle, pistol, longbow, harpoon, and plastic explosives. Subject never lies, always fulfills contractual obligations to the letter, and will not divulge any information about former employers or operations for any reason. Very cool. And they give it to you right there. Just that's it. That's your character model. Run with it.
I was a bit of a nitwit as a kid because I remember first reading that going, Well, if he worked for the CIA, how do they not know who he is? You know, like he was there filling out a W-2 and giving them his social security number.
Well, you know, when you're that age, that's what you think. You don't realize he's just, you know, like a guy taking a little money on the side. And
well, how does he cash the check they give him?
Yeah, I had that same thing. The one time I ever had a letter printed in a comic, I remember, you know, way back then, I would write letters every week. I'd pick up my comics and I'd pick something out and I'd write a letter. And the one that they finally printed was just so dumb when you think about it, because it was about Hulk 196. It was printed in Hulk 200. And what I did was the Abomination had demanded, so much money in jewelry or whatever. And my question was, well, what's he going to do with that? He can't just walk into a store and spend money. Like, you know, it was a dumb question when you think about it, but that just shows you the naivete of, you know, like a 12-year-old. Anyway. I obviously they have a full dossier on him, 'cause they even have his fingerprints on the printout.
And the printout looks like one of the file cards that was on the back of the figures.
Well, that's probably.
I was 11. Remember, this was like the sweet spot for me. I loved G.I. Joe toys as a kid.
Yeah, that's probably intentional too. That, you know, for the marketing purposes, that they do that for every character. I'm surprised if he was that popular, I'm surprised they didn't come out with a model for him or a figure for him.
Now, you'll probably see why as we go on. This issue was a bitch for me, I'm going to tell you now. Because I came
into this. Why is that? Oh, to find it?
Yes. I came into this series at number 5. That was my entry drug. And then I managed to buy, 1, 3, and 4. To get number 2, it took me forever. And then I had to overpay to get it. And it wasn't in good condition originally. But it was tough to find.
That's kind of a common thing with a lot of second issues that, you know, they would have a high print run on issue number 1. Because first issues always sold more. And then they would drop the print run for issue number 2 until they had a feeling for how many they were going to sell. So a lot of times issue number 2 had the lowest print run of a series. Right. So sometimes the second issue is the hardest one to find. It's not always the most valuable one, but it's the hardest to find, which ends up adding to its value just the same. But usually issue 1 is still more valuable than issue 2.
And then,
of course, just to add to the thought, when we talked about Don Perlin earlier, just wanted to throw in that he is the co-creator of Moon Knight, which would probably be his biggest claim to fame.
Yeah, so.
Okay, I'm sorry. Did I interrupt you?
I was just going to say, you know, I got issue 12, which was when Quinn returns. Before I got issue 2. So then there was the additional, you know, you had the little box saying, see issue number 2. Which then there was no other source to find out what happened until you got that book.
You know, that's one of those things where I look back on it and I, you know, you'd say back in my day, things were better because there was only 3 channels and, you know, like, and you're like, well, why does that make it better? But back in my day, I'd pick up a series or I'd pick up issues and I, you know, we did have a store where we can go to get back issues, you know, whatever they had. And, you know, you'd read a story and they'd say, oh, this happened in issue 35. And now issue 35 would become, you know, the holy grail that you're looking for until you get it. Then when you get that, there's a footnote that says, oh, this happened in issue 22. Now I need issue 22. That used to be part of the fun of being a collector, was to seek out those issues that were referenced in later ones. And you know, that was your source of the information too, because you know they weren't available necessarily in reprints all that readily, and you couldn't get them online. So to me, that was some of the excitement of collecting comics as a young collector, was being able to go back and, you know, get that issue that's referenced in a footnote, and now I own that. And some of it was, you know, silly stuff that, you know, they're referencing something, you know, that happened because they're building on it now. But when you look at it, you know, 40, 50 years later, you're saying, well, that wasn't really all that significant,
right.
But it felt significant at the time.
Yeah.
So to me, that was one of the things that was the most fun about collecting, was when I was able to get my hands on an issue that, you know, that was referenced and that I was interested in finding. And now all of a sudden I find it in the store on 19th Avenue and 86th Street at Joe Erb's comic store.
This one I couldn't get it. I couldn't get it at his. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get it there. I couldn't get it at, remember, Caesar's Bay Bazaar?
Mm-hmm.
I got it at a place I went to once. There was a comic shop on Bath Avenue and Bay Parkway.
I don't remember that place.
And that's where I got it. And I overpaid for it.
And you probably paid like $5.
No, I think it was upwards of that. I think it was in like the $10 range. And that was what, in 1985?
Oof. Yeah, and that's when you were, you know, 15 years old. So that's big bucks. Not only was it $1985, but it was a relatively young kid's $1985. So this issue, I think this is either the third or fourth G.I. Joe. I think this is the fourth G.I. Joe issue that I'm handling on an episode of Bins. And this is by far, not even close, this is by far my favorite of the bunch. Zaki Hassan brought on one that was, I think it was like a big, what's his name? Who's this, the silent guy?
Snake Eyes.
It was a big Snake Eyes issue. And I could see where it was significant, but it still didn't pull me in the way this one did. This was an excellent issue as far as I'm concerned.
It has enough connections to the real world too, because I think there was some kind of thing the Russians were working on, where we had a problem with our embassy in Cuba too, where they were beaming some kind of a signal that was causing problems for people, making them sick or something like that. Those good old days of the Cold War.
I'm just thinking now, too. It just occurred to me that Quinn, which is spelled here K-W-I-N-N, has got to be a reference to Quinn the Eskimo, which is I believe Bob Dylan wrote the song, and Manfred Mann recorded it. And I believe that's Q-U-I-N-N. But Quinn the Eskimo, it's got to be the same. This has got to be a reference to that.
You know, what's interesting about the first few issues is it goes on, you know, that Cobra is the villain in every single issue later. But it's about the first four issues or so where they wrote, you know, it's not always them. It's different groups and the Russians and
Yeah,
gave a little more variety.
Which is better. I think that's better, because when it just starts being the same people, then it becomes like Inspector Gadget and, you know, the same villain in every issue, every episode, or the Smurfs with Gargamel in every episode. You know, I think having a varied group of opponents is a positive.
Yeah, no, definitely.
But sometimes with some of these series, it's like they find the key antagonist and they can never match up to it with any other things. I'm thinking of like the Micronauts. Yeah, they had some very good issues, but they were never as good as when Baron Carzo was the villain.
Mm.
So they kept having to bring him back and bring him back and bring him back, because he, you know, he made that series.
Well, I know with this, Larry Hama has said there was a lot of, hey, you need to put this in there because we have to move this. It might have been. We got to move these Cobra figures. We're not making Russians, so get with the program.
So you ready to rate this one, or you have anything more on it?
I don't know. I think I'm ready. This book, it took me a long time to get, but once I got it, I enjoyed the hell out of it. And it hasn't declined at all in my opinion over the years. The cover's great. It's an action-packed cover. It symbolically represents what's in the book. It's a great army image. It's got the drama of being at the North Pole. To me, this is an A cover. If I had seen it back then, I would have picked it up. Unfortunately, I missed it and paid through the nose to get it. The interior art, I think, is good. I really enjoy it. It starts to give you, it'll be tweaked over the years, but this is, it's a good look for it. And I'm going to give the interior art an A-. And I just love the story. It's a fantastic story. It's exciting. There's a certain extent of, I mean, this came first, I think, I may be wrong, with the four of them working together. There's almost like an A-team vibe I get off it when they're building the sailboat. I can almost hear in my head the theme song from the A-team. And like I said, it's just a blast. I'm giving it an A. So for me, an overall grade of an A-.
Yeah, you know, this is the first one that I'm reading where it's giving me a real feel for why this was a popular series. And again, a lot of the later criticism that I had when we did other issues was, I'm not familiar with what's in front of us. And it's escaping me for that reason, because this was all, you know, I was too old for this when it came out. But now, you know, starting it at the ground floor with this issue, which I really do feel is the ground floor issue, I'm much more enamored with this series. I really like the cover. The cover is by Herb Trimpe and Jack Abel, by the way. And it shows, you know, the four of them in their winter gear with the barracks exploding behind them. I love the way the flames are reflected on the rock wall next to them. I just think that's an excellent touch. I think the colors pop. I think this would not be the right cover for issue number one, which, even though I'm saying that this would be a perfect issue number one, this is a great cover for issue number two, though. And I think it's exciting. And like you say, it pulls you right in. I'm going to say an A on the cover. I really think it's very, very good. The interior art, I think, does set the tone. It's very, very serviceable. It very much fits the, you know, the topic and the style of story that we have here. It's not quite an A, but I think it's a solid B+. And the story, this is the way the story should be done, as far as I'm concerned. This is an A+ story, because it really pulls you in. It introduces you to the characters. It doesn't let you get bogged down with the characters. It moves it right along. And it gives you a very satisfying story overall. So I'm going to say an A+ on the story. And I'm going to overall give the book an A.
All right. I'm glad I finally brought a decent one.
You brought decent ones before, but now you've brought a decent G.I. Joe.
Yeah, that's what I meant.
Good stuff. I don't know when our next war book is going to be, but when we do it, I guess it will be a Storming Paradise episode when we do our next war books. So I think that will do it for this episode, though. I hope everybody enjoyed listening to us drone on about these books. And just remember, war is hell, but me and Dave are nice guys.
Yo, Joe.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for listening to our show, and we hope you'll continue to join us each and every week for more good old-fashioned comic book back issue awesomeness. You can contact Back to the Bins to leave feedback, comments, questions, suggestions, and criticisms via email at bins@twotruefreaks.com or by joining the Back to the Bins group on Facebook. Back to the Bins is a proud affiliate of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network, which you may find at www.twotruefreaks.com. Two True Freaks is a registered trademark of DiMonzo Corp of Milan, Italy. All rights reserved. Please take a moment to stop by the twotruefreaks.com site and check out their many other fine podcasts, won't you? Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Mighty Quinn von Manfred Mann! Everybody's gonna jump for joy. Come on without. All the pigeons gonna run to him. Come on without. Here, everybody's gonna wanna doze. Come on without. Yes,